Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Film producer and director Kerry Kendall is showing the first two documentaries of his Beethoven trilogy. Films are about the global impact of Beethoven's music, the role music can play in the healing and repair of our communities and ourselves. The first part of the trilogy, Following the Ninth, follows the music to China, Chile, Germany, and Japan. The second part, Love and Justice, takes us to Chile once more, using Beethoven's Fidelio to explore the darkness of political repression and the way Chileans try to sustain hope in the shadow of Pinochet. The third part, Last Will and Testament, will follow the footsteps of Beethoven's powerful late quartets. And so we welcome in Kerry Kendall. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. It's nice to be back in Salt Lake City.
It's great to have you. I understand you're on the road with these two films, Utah, and then what? Colorado and where else?
Well, it's about 15 shows in Colorado, beginning in Telluride, on to Aspen and Boulder, Denver, various other places, and then down to Santa Fe and Albuquerque, and over to Arizona for a couple screenings, a couple in Sedona, and then home. I'm on the road for about a month. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, we want to jump into these films and Beethoven and Beethoven's impact. Before we do that, I hope it's okay. Before we were talking before we went on the air, you shared some interesting facts about your family that I think people would like to know. So your mother has an interesting claim to fame.
She does indeed. And it really was the first foray into film that I got into. My brother, Kelly, I'm an identical twin. He thought it would be a nice idea to do this film about what was called the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which my mother played in. That was the professional league in the 1940s when women played professional baseball while a lot of the men were off fighting in the Second World War. So she and her sister, both from Vancouver, played in that league. It basically disappeared as an historical fact, historical league. And so my brother pushed it forward as an idea. I helped out a bit. That film started out as a documentary called A League of Their Own and focused on the women. And we found some archival footage, interviewed the surviving women, including my mother and her sister. And it went on to be that film, the other A League of Their Own, the lesser League of Their Own, with Tom Hanks, Gina Davis, Rosie O'Donnell. And, oh, yes, that woman named Madonna.
Yeah.
So that was an unusual. So my mother had we didn't know this about her, but she was a great athlete, and she didn't talk about it much. She was a shy woman. Interestingly enough, my younger brother, who took after my mother, also played professional baseball for 7-8 years with the Montreal Expos and the Houston Astros. So it's the only mother-son baseball combination in professional baseball. So that's how I got into this mess.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's amazing. Yeah. So I was watching, you can find this on your site, the main site for your trilogy, BeethovenHero.com. And you were illustrating to folks at a TEDx talk, TEDx Purdue, that, you know, we all know the Ode to Joy. So you started humming it and the audience started humming it along. and then you mentioned it. I love this aside. You say, if you haven't been to the concert hall, you probably know it from Die Hard 3.
Yes, Die Hard 3, 4, 9, whatever it was, it's often used. But yes, we do know it. And if there are two things that most people know about Beethoven, they probably know that tune and might not know where it's from, but it's so common. And a lot of kids learn it when they're playing piano initially. And then we know, the other thing we know about Beethoven is that he was deaf. So those two factoids play a part in this, the popular culture of the Ninth Symphony.
Yeah.
But I was inspired to go around the world and find out the significance of that symphony.
Yeah, we'll hear some clips. It's amazing the power that music can have, especially this music. I want to have you set this up, and then I want to play a little bit from this TEDx talk, principally because you in the talk you play some of the music that affected you. So how did you come to Beethoven, and specifically the Ninth Symphony?
Yes, well, I was a child of rock and roll, and growing up with my father listening to some people like Ray Charles and the crooners, Sinatra and others. But I was in love with rock and roll, and I didn't really know anybody who listened to classical music. It just wasn't part of my emotional, intellectual, musical world. Until I borrowed a friend's car and I was driving from Los Angeles to Santa Barbara. He was the only friend I knew who listened to classic music. He had a cassette in his, it's back that far. He had a cassette in his car, and I was driving along the coast, and I just pushed it in because that's what you do if there's a cassette in the car and you want to hear some music. I didn't know what it was. And out of these bad speakers came this sublime music, and it was so stunningly beautiful that I thought, who is this? What is this? And why don't I know more about it? So I set to the business of finding out. It was Beethoven. It was the Adagio from the Ninth Symphony, the slow movement, and I just fell in love with it. And I started to read, started to listen, started to find my way into that world. And that was in my probably mid to late 20s.
Well, it's
So it's a revelation.
let's hear a little bit of this because we can hear some of this music which affected you so much. This is from Carrie Kandel's TEDx Purdue talk. Let's just hear a bit.
I hope. Now, to me, that was overwhelming. It touched me. This is the third movement, the Adagio, the slow movement of the Ninth Symphony. After this comes the fireworks of the finale. But I felt like that touched me in such a deep way, in a profound way, in the same way that my rock and roll had, that I had grown up with, the Beatles, with Dylan. And I had to find out more and listen more, and as I listened further into the fourth movement, this is what I heard.
We embrace harmony, making consensus, talking with others is important.
So there's a bit from TEDx. Purdue, and alert our audience.
Japanese love.
Let's see. Let me turn that off there. Our guests can't hear what we're playing here. A little fault in our system. So we just played a little bit. Carrie Kandel from the TEDx talk. I wanted people to hear that adagio that so affected you. And you go on to say in that TEDx talk that this affected you the same way that, say, the Beatles had earlier in your life.
It was quite a shock, and then to dig in to other pieces by Beethoven, I started to listen to the piano sonatas and the symphonies other than the ninth, and found my way to the late quartets, and all of them were fascinating and challenging and sometimes confusing. But simultaneous to my listening to all of this music, I was studying history, and the period of history that I love is the late 18th and early 19th century. I went on to study, do graduate work in history in New York and in Santa Barbara. So that combination made sense to me. Beethoven was living in during the late 18th century. He was 19 when the French Revolution broke out. So the music and the man and the time, that whole thing was perfect for me. I loved the history. I loved the music. And the man himself was utterly fascinating. So perfect combination.
And you said this funny line from your talk that you then became an evangelizer for Beethoven. You know, it's almost like knocking on the door. Hey, have you encountered Beethoven in your life?
Well, I say I became a Beethoven's witness.
A Beethoven's witness. Yes, there you go. Yeah.
I mean, for people who don't know, it's a reference to Jehovah's Witnesses, which, you know, everyone I'm assuming Jehovah's Witnesses knock on everyone's door, but they certainly have knocked on mine a few times. So it was like walking. Yeah, have you heard of it? If my friends try to convert them from the subpar music of rock and roll to this great high-end, high-culture product called classical music. It's a bad name for it, but Beethoven, you have to listen to Beethoven. It's like handing around pamphlets or something.
So you say the ninth, of course, this is at the near the end of his life, and you say he's looking back at this point at a time when he was more idealistic. You get to the great Ode to Joy. This the circumstances in his life, he could have been very pessimistic with this music, but he wasn't. Why do you think that is?
I think, you know, he was 18 or 19, born in 1770, so the French Revolution breaks out in 1789. But prior to that, there was this whole Enlightenment ideas about equality, challenging all the social structures, the clergy, the aristocracy, educational institutions. Well, there was an opening up, in other words, of the intellectual life, and a lot of it was very idealistic. It was a turning. It was a turning point in modern history, essentially, that Beethoven walked into. And Wordsworth, when the French Revolution broke out in 1789, which is, you know, that's a challenge to the monarchies across Europe. Two of them, I mean, the king and queen were eventually beheaded in 1793. But Wordsworth, writing from England, said, "Bliss it was in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven." Beethoven had imbibed all of these ideas of the Enlightenment about equality, about challenging the status quo, and then the French Revolution breaks out. And that's a hinge point in history, where history turns dramatically. So he was enraptured by that movement. And he was also, as a lot of your listeners will know, fascinated by the figure of Beethoven. Because Beethoven, Napoleon is what I meant.
Yes.
This young man from Corsica who was not an aristocrat, who rose to the heights of power in France, eventually crowned himself emperor. Well, in Beethoven's eyes, anybody who had the skill and the intelligence and the willpower, which he did, could certainly prove themselves in the eyes of anybody who cared to look, just on the basis of achievement and skill. The aristocracy was born into their position. Beethoven thought, well, I am just as good or better than any of these frivolous people. By the way, and he said it, there's only one of me. There are many of you aristocrats. You were born to it, and there'll be hundreds and thousands more born to it, but there's one Beethoven. So then the idea of equality based on that kind of merit that the French Revolution brought to play, and somebody like Napoleon embodied, appealed to Beethoven immensely.
And of course, we have the Third Symphony, right? Which I think is
Eroica, yeah.
Eroica, the Ode to Napoleon. I guess by the end of his life, kind of lost some of that idealism, but he was trying to recapture this, was he? Or looking back, I don't know if he ever lost it.
I think he was in a very odd position. I mean, there's a dual revolution taking place. So there's a capitalist revolution and there's a political revolution, which is the French Revolution. What does capitalism revolution mean? Well, there's a burgeoning middle class, and the aristocracy is eventually going to disappear, and this new class is going to take power. That's simplifying, but Beethoven was in an odd position where he took money from aristocrats. They paid him for his music, but in an interesting turn from, say, someone that was writing music in Louis XIV's court, they didn't call the tune. Beethoven called the tune. He wrote what he wanted to write. He was paid by aristocrats, but he wrote what he wanted to write. He was an individual born into a moment of equality, and looking back from 1824 with the Ninth Symphony, I think he's saying again, these are my essential values that I've carried with me from my youth. Because in the Ode to Joy, the key line is "Alle Menschen werden Brüder," all men will be brothers. That was important to him. Whether he acted that out in individual relationships is another matter. So as an abstract sense of yes, it's not a utopian blueprint. It's just a utopian yearning, an utopian impulse that moment when he was 18 in his youth and saw the world change and the possibilities of equality, fraternity, liberty, the slogans of the French Revolution happening, I think he was still attached to that, attached to those values.
Of course, I think a fact that I think a lot of people know, I want to have you talk about this, he was going deaf at the end of his life. Which would be very, very hard for anyone, but for a composer, I can't even imagine. How did that affect him, do you think? He's composing this, would be his last symphony, and he's going deaf.
Well, he was going deaf a long time before that. It was in 1898, or 1798, where he discovers that he's going deaf. It was somewhat of a gradual process. It's a double catastrophe for him because he was a virtuoso piano player, and he made his living playing piano in part in public performances. To not be able to do that, he was the best at improvising that anybody had ever seen at the time. So he made a living doing that. So to lose that capacity was one catastrophe. To lose access to social situations, social life, companionship, that's another one. And he wrote about it in a famous letter when he finally figured out in 1802, basically, he will never recover his hearing. And he wrote about one of the most interesting documents in the history of music, where he writes about his deafness. And he writes, it's almost a suicide note. But at the end of it, he says, "I would leave this earth, but it is my art that keeps me here. I need to accomplish something. I will stay until I feel like I've done that." And that's the drive that the man had. I mean, as my friend George Matthews says in the film, he's one of the greatest manipulators of sound that we know. And for that person to go deaf is what a cosmic joke. A double catastrophe, but the will of the man, pushed him through it and to be able to create, I mean, not just one, not two, not three, but, how many great works that we still listen to today. Remarkable thing.
Let's head toward a break here soon, but you mentioned George Matthews. I wanted to play just a little bit from this. He's describing the beginning of Beethoven's Ninth. And so this is a composer talking about another composer, giving us some insights here. So let's just play just a little bit of this. From Following the Ninth, we have with us the producer and director, Carrie Kandel.
The whole thing is a kind of creation story or an evolution story. I mean, the first thing is not a thing. It's a nothing. What on earth is that? And then when it starts to move, the Spirit of God hovering over the waters, what you get is... And then you have this cataclysmic event. It's pure violence. That is primordial violence. That is the Big Bang. This peace enters your bloodstream and then changes who you are. The entire blueprint of everything.
So there's a little bit from Following the Ninth, Carrie Kandel's film. That's George Matthew describing the music at the very beginning of the symphony. Very, very interesting. So let's take a break. When we come back, I'll ask Carrie Kandel why these films and what he hopes to accomplish through these. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with film producer and director Carrie Kandel. So these films are about the global impact of Beethoven's music and the role music can play in the healing and repair of our communities and ourselves. So, Carrie Kandel, you've earlier in the program, you told how you discovered Beethoven. You borrowed a friend's car and pushed play on that cassette, and your life was changed. So let's talk about the first film, Following the Ninth. What did you hope to accomplish? What was your goal with that film?
I don't know what my goal was. I think the interesting thing about making films, these kinds of films, I mean, anybody who makes films really, or any art in general, you don't know what's going to happen to it. The making of it is, if one is lucky enough to get to do it, is a wonderful part. The traveling with colleagues, and these are collective efforts. These films are done with teams. It isn't like writing a poem. That's the great part. I mean, people say there are three films that are made: the one that you think about and pre-produce and sketch out, maybe in your head, maybe on a storyboard, maybe some other way, and the one you actually shoot, and then the one you actually edit. But the making of the film is the fun part. So I didn't know what was going to happen to this film, the ninth film. It was a blast making it. I was lucky enough to be able to travel the world and make it. Some people have told me I should have, you can make a film in your backyard. But this one was so compelling to me as I found out more and more about the stories that I thought, well, no one else is doing it, so I might as well. But it takes a while. It takes a while, but you don't know where it's going to end up. So I didn't know anyone would buy it. I didn't know anyone would watch it. I'm lucky enough that it got a lot of nice attention. And then to think, well, I should make a trilogy. That's kind of Captain Ahab territory, where you want to make three films. You don't really come out of, I don't come out of this classical music world, so what right do I have? Well, it's kind of a punk attitude. It's a do-it-yourself thing. I'll do it because I'm an outsider and I think I have an interesting perspective on this music. I love people's stories, so why not make a trilogy? And it'll be as successful as the Lord of the Rings trilogy, won't it? There'll be Beethoven action figures in the the McDonald's, you know, toys that they give out with their meals, with their Happy Meals. I don't know. I just do it because I love doing it. I have the opportunity to do it. I get good support from people who like what I'm doing, and I do them because I don't know. No one else is doing it, and I hope it contributes somehow to this, at least the cinematic depiction of Beethoven's work and world. And so when you go to the Wikipedia page for the Ninth Symphony, my film's there, so that might be a success.
I think that's a score. Yeah, that's a success. Yeah.
But I make them for my children too, and my family. Mm-hmm. I like the fact that they'll be able to see them when they want to at some future date, and they'll be able to have a different perspective on what their dad was up to for all those years.
Are your children? I guess they're probably into the popular music of the day. I don't know. They maybe haven't press play on whatever today's equivalent of the cassette is on Beethoven's Ninth.
Yeah, they did take up music. One of my daughters plays cello, the other one sings, and a lot of not contemporary music, but mostly they're listening to whatever's happening.
Yeah,
right now. But they are musical people, so I love that.
That's good. I'd like to have you tell in brief a couple of stories in the film, but there's a fascinating person, kind of a centerpiece in the film. His name is Feng Congdi.
Feng Congda?
Yes.
I always worry about pronunciation.
Right. Tell me a bit about him.
Well, it's an amazing story. He was destined, really, as a well-educated Chinese person, a male in college with his aspirations to study in the United States or Europe. He was waiting to get that news when the events of Tiananmen Square broke out in the spring of 1989. He didn't really know what he wanted to do about that. He wasn't an activist to begin with. His computer breaks down, so he can't continue. I think he was writing a paper or some kind of, I'm not sure if it was a dissertation or something, but his computer breaks down and he can't write. He can't study or he can't do what he was supposed to be doing. So he goes down to the square and ends up being one of the leaders on the square. I mean, this is so strange to me, and it's so perfect because I think that life works like that often. We think we're going this way, but we end up going that way. Something changes, and our plans that we had for our future just happen to change, and we're redirected. And in his case, I titled that chapter of the film, I mean, when I tell that story, when he tells that story, Become Who You Are, because he didn't know what he was supposed to become. And I have a sense that he became what he was supposed to become by moving down to the square, becoming a leader. I mean, he had to not just step out of his dorm room, but actually walk onto the square and then pick up a bullhorn and start talking and start organizing. And then he becomes one of the most 10 wanted individuals after the Tiananmen events, after the crushing of the students on the square and others. Most of the students were not harmed, but the people that were killed were mostly the people that surrounded the square, trying to protect that movement. So he becomes one of the 10 most wanted individuals and ends up fleeing the country, and he becomes a human rights activist. I mean, it's very strange. It's just life has these curveballs. It's perfect for documentary because his documentary is not scripted. So one can be driving down the road and turn left and turn right and find some interesting thing to do that you didn't expect. I mean, when you make a documentary, and that happens several times, with some very interesting results. So Feng Congda represents that interesting, fascinating moment where you think you're doing one thing and you end up doing another. And basically, I think he says it's the right thing that I did.
Yeah, it's a fascinating character. I want to play next just a bit of a clip from Following the Night. This takes us to Chile. You've gone to Chile twice now, right? This a part of Following the Night, and then an entire film set there and connecting up experiences of Chileans with Beethoven's opera Fidelio. Let's hear just a bit of this clip from Following the Night.
In 1973 began a very dark time. Pinochet took the power and he made one of the worst military coups. This dream from socialism, from equality, was gone.
Banished. And happiness was banished. I was in a room with a window with the iron grid. And one day I heard the music, only the music.
Like a shield against the fear, against the pain, against the darkness.
When you are in the deepest, darkest hole, the music was hope.
So that's and I'm sorry, Kerry Kandel, you can't hear that, but that's the portion where the men are in prison, and the women are outside singing the Ode to Joy, and you interview a gentleman who was one of the prisoners. He said that it gave us hope.
It was nice symphony.
Just to preface,
let me stop that there.
We
go ahead.
It wasn't until Google came along that I could actually find some of these stories, and because I could put in an alert that let me know anything that was having to do with the Ninth Symphony would come into my mail. So everybody knew that, or anyone who was reading the paper at the time knew that Leonard Bernstein had taken the Ninth Symphony to Germany, played it in East Berlin, West Berlin. Knew that Tiananmen Square had happened, but didn't really know what the students were doing. But this case, I started seeing stories about the Ninth in Chile, and I thought, wow, that's fascinating. I who would have thought? And I was not happy. I was 19 when the coup happened there in 1973, September 11th, 1973, when the U.S. helped overthrow a democratically elected socialist government of Salvador Allende. So I thought, this is fascinating. I want to go and do a part of the film in Chile and find these individuals. And I did. I just have to ask around. One thing leads to another. And I found this man who had been tortured in prison. Machi is his nickname. And while he was in prison, he heard women outside the prison walls singing the Ode to Joy in Spanish, of course, their version. And I thought, well, that's amazing. And he describes it as colorful butterflies that he heard coming over the walls. Just imagine, I mean, he has no idea if he's going to get out, but he hears this community of women singing to him and others. But what I didn't have was the film of the women singing. That was almost impossible to find. I got very, very lucky. Again, this is the magic of documentaries. I finally found footage of these women singing. So the two come together and create this. I think it's a very powerful scene and one of the great experiences of making this documentary. And I've been to Chile now 5 times. I fell in love with the country and fell in love with the people I met there and interviewed many people like Machi who never made it into this film. those who were imprisoned and tortured after the dictatorship took power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the power of music, right? Yeah. One more thing absolutely. On... Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was saying absolutely agree with you.
Yeah, yeah. One more thing on Following the Ninth, then I want to take a break and come back and talk about the second film, which is back in Chile. So I learned this from your film, that the Ninth, called The Great Ninth, is big in Japan. They have annual performances.
Yes, it's remarkable. I mean, what they do, it's complicated history of how that happened, but they now in every December it's played hundreds of times across the country, and sometimes with the chorus of 10,000, sometimes 15,000 people. They invite. I mean, they spend 6 months, the participants, 6 months learning the German. They sing in German, so going from Japanese to German is very difficult. So they have these senseis that teach them how to sing the music. It's an amazing collective experience, and they invite people to stand by them from all over the world and participate. The critics, of course, the connoisseurs of music, don't like it because 10,000 people singing in a big hall. I mean, you can imagine sound waves do not move quickly enough to make that sound good. Even if you could get a 10,000 person choir to sing well from Japanese into German. But I have to say that the experience is just overwhelming. And I want to go back to Japan, which I've been to probably, I think, 3 or 4 times to film these events. I want to go back and sing, because when you're holding a camera and filming, you can't really feel it. And I want to stand in that orchestra or that choir and sing, that choral group.
Yeah, that must be a powerful experience to be part of it. Yeah.
I would think so. Plus, I'd have to learn my German.
Yeah, right. Improve your German, yeah. Well, let's take another break. When we come back, I want to talk about the second film. More with Carrie Kandel following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We just have about 6 minutes or so left in a brief final segment here with Carrie Kandel. You went back to Chile, and you're looking at Beethoven's opera Fidelio. Tell us just briefly about Fidelio. What's the basic story?
Well, the plot is very simple. It's a story of a political prisoner who was trapped in a dungeon by a tyrant named Pizarro. The prisoner's name is Florestan. His wife, Leonora, thinks he's imprisoned there and gets a job in the dresses as a man and gets a job in the prison in an attempt to save him if he's there. She does save him, and happily ever after. That's the Fidelio story. Political prisoner who's there for protesting some injustice. We don't know quite what it is. But it's a story about an incredibly brave, courageous woman who is determined to save her husband and does. In a sense, it's in the context of Beethoven's fantasy world, he created a fantasy lover of great moral clarity and conviction, because he, in his own life, never had a lover, never had a wife, wanted one, wanted a family, botched all of that. It was a social incompetent, among other things, unpleasant. But that's the story. And what's the weird part is this. I knew that I could do a film in Chile about imprisonment and what that means, and because I'd interviewed so many people there. And I thought that I would go there and interview some of the families and create a story out of that. bring these things together, bring these concerns of mine together. But right before I left to make this film there, I found out that there was a woman named Maria Belen Espinosa Peña. She is a Buto artist, which is a Japanese art form, a dance art form, kind of like mine, but, you know, just with some additional and unique aspects that are Japanese. She dresses as her grandfather, who was murdered by the military in 1973, October of 1973. Her grandfather happened to be a composer and a conductor, Jorge Peña Hen. She dresses as him and performs his life, performs his creation of a children's orchestra, performs the conflict, the coup, his arrest, his murder, and his resurrection in her terms. She believes that she invites him to come back to life and embody her body, to take over her body and help her perform her routine, her dance, her art. So I thought, this is crazy. Here's a woman who dresses as a man to save this person's memory from vanishing from the face of the earth.
That's amazing.
Strange. This is so uncanny. She's redoing the Fidelio story. I thought, well, I have my film. And it took a long time to make it happen because it's so complicated. I invited Beethoven there too. He's haunting the scene. I tell a bit of my story. I tell a bit of the conflict of the coup and the aftermath, the murder of the conductor and this woman who brings him back. And then it has a little twist to it that at the end, where it's not quite the Fidelio story, it turns into something else. So that's just a teaser.
Yeah. Well, that's very effective. I don't want to end without having people hear just a bit of this fascinating woman's, Maria Belen's, voice. So let's just hear just a very short snippet from Love and Justice here.
We could say that I dress like a man to save my grandfather.
Of course, much more in the film. We are out of time, so let me just say we've been talking with the producer and director of those films, Carrie Kandel. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure. Wonderful to be here.